I'm going to be talking tomorrow on BBC about Libya, 100 days after Gaddafi. And it's the same scenario. You have tribal organizations trying to figure out, okay, who's in charge here? How are we going to form a government? What's going to happen? This is the real heavy lifting part of the Arab Spring. And quite frankly, it's the heavy lifting part of the global Occupy movement. You've done something incredible in that if you look at what we were talking about 3-4 months ago when the Occupy movement started, it was deficits, it was cut entitlements, it was anything other than addressing the issue that is now in the forefront, which is the fundamental economic unfairness of the system. To go in 4 months' time from that to where we are today is nothing short of incredible. And to this you can thank the Occupy movement, you can thank the Arab Spring, you can thank all of these coming together in such a way where the world is finally saying, you know what? What they're saying makes sense. Why do these bankers have the power that they have? Why do people in government have the control that they have? And it's just, and this is the link that I make between the Arab Spring and Occupy, because it's so natural. You have a demographic time bomb exploding across the Middle East where these old men in their 70s and 80s who are controlling all of the wealth and power are not in a position to just hand it down to the next generation. And you have millions of people living substandardly trying to figure out how we're going to feed ourselves and what's the economy going to look like. When those powers clash, as they're clashing in the U.S., as they're clashing in Egypt, as they're about to clash in Iran. Iran has elections coming up in 2 months' time. All of it spells great period of uncertainty and change around the globe.
Let me ask you a related question. Are you getting some interesting tweets from the Syrian situation?
Yes and no. Syria is such a tragic story on so many levels because, again, it's an example of very much like Libya, where the army and the government are one. And even worse in Syria, the number of mercenaries that have been hired by al-Bashir are stunning. And the carnage that has been wreaked in some of the villages, Homs and others, is just... It's heart-rending. And the ineffectiveness of the Arab League monitors to stop the crisis and the fact that they're now all withdrawing.
That's right. I heard they were packing out.
It's just further indication of how bad the situation is there. You do get tweets, but you're not in a position to know what's really going on there because there is no media on the ground. If you look back to Egypt, if you look back to Tunisia, you had reporters who were willing to risk their lives on the ground there. And it's one of the things that, when we sell copies of the book Egypt Unshackled, we donate to an international fund that is helping Egyptian families, families of journalists that were killed, seriously injured, and can no longer do their job. Because globally, journalists have become huge targets. And there are so many of these strongmen that don't want the word to get out as to what's going on in their country that it's really quite shocking.
Now, I understand that Iran has a very technologically educated and technologically implemented society. Are there comparable tweets from Iran, or are those... again, not to the volume that would give you a good enough roundup of opinion?
Iran's kind of tricky because you have so many separatist movements and groups. And what I've seen, most of my work with Iran has been focused on, of all things, a refugee camp that is based in Iraq.
Yeah, I've heard of that.
It's 60 miles north of Baghdad and 60 miles away from the border with Iran. It's called Camp Ashraf. And this particular area, these people have lived there for 25 years. and they call themselves the People's Mujahideen of Iran. And what they are is they are a group of former freedom fighters who have been placed in a refugee camp. They have a government in exile led by a woman, Madame Rajavi, and you have a lot of controversy around this particular group because back in 1997, they were placed on the State Department's list of terrorist organizations. Now, they still remain on the State Department's lists, but however, if you come to the UK or the EU, they've been removed as a terrorist organization. And in fact, the UK House of Lords, the European Parliament, and several former states leaders, the Prime Minister of Iceland, several countries have come together to form a committee that looks into atrocities that are being committed against Ashraf. Ashraf has had, I think, four attacks in the last 3 or 4 years, resulting in many injuries and death. The people in the camp are denied medical treatment, and they are a thorn in the side of the Iranian regime because they were longtime opponents of both the Shah as well as the current mullahs. So you have a situation where this group is now sitting there exposed. When the U.S. troops were there in Iraq, they were afforded protection by the United Nations and by U.S. troops. A year ago, under the Status of Forces Agreement, we pulled back to base all the U.S. troops. This is when some of the more serious attacks against this group of 3,400 people began, and now they are pretty much out there in the open since the U.S. has completely withdrawn troops from Iraq. So we're in a situation where, as we cover this story, there are probably 6 or 7 different groups that could do something, from the United Nations to the European Union to the United States to Iraq, the Iranian government, but nobody's doing anything, and these people are literally being used as pawns. And so when I look at, you know, what's happening to them, the family members back in Iran are being systematically arrested, tortured, and killed. Yet they're not helping themselves either because of their shaky connections in the past. And it's very, very hard to know what the real answer is, except all I see are 3,400 sitting ducks in the middle of this desert that could end up in a genocide. Now, the latest on that is that the United Nations is in the process of relocating them into the former Camp Liberty, which was the big base for U.S. troops. Now, if you listen to people that are involved with the families, they say it's a concentration camp. United Nations says it's a good solution. The problem is you have such a corrupt government in Iraq that you don't know who's sold out what to whom. Obviously, with the Iraqi Prime Minister, Nouri al-Maliki, he's got a very, very dangerous internal situation where Sunni and Shia are constantly fighting. To keep the Iranian side happy, he's going to allow and sort of turn his back on a lot of things that would normally have been handled by the U.S. and the United Nations. And you just have this incredibly turbulent situation. And it's so turbulent that you've even had U.S. politicians involved speaking on behalf of the PMOI and Madame Rajavi. You had Rudy Giuliani, you had Thomas Mukasey, you've had the first Homeland Secretary, Tom Ridge, Patrick Kennedy, the Democrat, former congressman from Rhode Island. They've all been involved in throwing support behind this organization, but they do so at risk because they're still on the State Department list as a terrorist organization. And back in August, they were supposed to have been taken off the list, or a decision was supposed to have been made. We're now into January of the next year. Almost 6 months have gone by. No decision has been taken to their status. And, you know, frankly, anybody that provides aid or comfort, including Giuliani and others, now could be considered criminals for simply trying to say, wait a minute, this doesn't make any sense. And the only reason they were placed on this list back in 1997 was because a new government was coming into Iran and it was making signs of being a more moderate government. So it was thrown on there by Bill Clinton, and they basically said, that's fine, that helps us. But what happened was, as they were, you know, talking nice to us, they were simultaneously developing a nuclear program. So you just don't know who's giving you correct information and what to do with that information when you have it.
Yeah. Well, I'm guessing that with Mr. Giuliani's connections, he shouldn't be worried about packing his bags for that trip to Guantanamo.
No, but it's such a stupid designation, because I mean, here you've got the, you know, you've got two governments, major governments, and other parts that are looking at it and saying, you know, this is stupid, and no longer are they listed in such. You know, I used to contribute to Truthout, and you know, they got their knickers in a twist over this, because the Iranian propaganda machine is legend. And the minute you post anything that is anti-Iran, their tweets, their comments, their everything is focused on whoever says something bad about Iran and the Iranian regime. And, you know, Truthout, which has always said, well, we're for free and open journalism, we fight for truth and freedom, threw me under the bus.
Yeah,
because the heat got too hot. You say, yep. Guys, this is the whole idea, is that, you know, you're going up against something. You're not giving aid and comfort. You're talking about this situation that has existed for 25 years out there in the middle of this desert, and you have 3,400 sitting ducks. What is the government going to do? They won't touch it. They won't look at it, and they dropped all stories that I ever wrote about it from their website because of this fear of, and it's an irrational fear of being upset and finding themselves on, you know, providing aid and comfort. It's not about that at all. It's about the fact you've got these people sitting in the desert. I get very upset with even the PMOI because of the flood of propaganda they send across my desk every day. I get three or four emails that are all official urgent statements, and I keep telling them, you're not helping yourself, because it's not urgent. You need to only focus on making certain that you have the parliamentary support of the UK and the EU, and then release your statement. You know, this compilation that you do of every minor transgression or every little thing that happens is not helping your case. So people need to learn how to deal with the media in something other than, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, the world's on fire.
Yep. Well, Dennis, I can't thank you enough. I wish you the best of luck on your book, Egypt Unshackled. And I want you to know that you're always welcome to come back and give us an update, okay?
Okay, thanks, Rick.
And thank you, sir. Have a real good day.
You too.
Well, that was excellent, sir.
Okay.
Really excellent.
I apologize for the break in the middle.
Oh, don't worry about it. I go in and take out a few ums and ors anyway.
Okay, good.
But thank you, and we'll be airing that this Sunday.
Oh, fab. All right. I'll if you send me a link, what I'll do is I'll tweet it out to my group.
Will do.
And let them know that this is going to happen, and we'll go from there.
Let me ask you one other off-topic question. Sure. What do you hear of the Assange case? Are they going to throw him to the wolves?
I don't know.
What's your gut tell you?
My gut tells me that if he goes to Sweden, he goes from there straight to the U.S.
Yeah, or disappeared.
Yeah, yeah. You know, he's his own worst enemy.
Well, I heard he's going to start his own show.
Yeah.
Which should be interesting.
With Russia Today, he's going to have his own program. But I really get upset when individuals place themselves above the movement that they purport to be representing.
Well, ego and revolutionaries, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, that's always the issue. I mean, if you look at Wael Gonim in Egypt, He didn't want the spotlight. He reluctantly stepped into the spotlight. He immediately stepped back out of the spotlight after the 18 days were over, became a force behind the scenes, always was focused on the good of the country and how do I help my country. Even then, he's had nothing but crap from people.
Sure.
So I don't really know what's – I mean, the fact that Assange was in a three-way, you know, and seemed to be enjoying it. And it, I have a problem with people that inhale. And by inhale, I mean, you know, they take in the essence of their story and become their story.
Yeah.
And that can never end well. Because what it does is it takes all of the good things that you've done and it just diminishes them because people don't know who you are and they don't know what you stand for. And I think this has been the big issue with Assange, is that he's done good work, I think. I think the stuff that he's released has needed to be released. And the other issue I have with him is that he just does dumps and makes everybody else go through the information. I've always felt he would be far more successful and far more impactful if he were to take all this data and cull through it and put it into packages that talk about the CIA in Rome, the CIA in Cairo, the CIA in such and such, the military here. And so that you ended up with a series of books rather than here's 300,000 pages, have at it.
Well, you know, to be the devil's advocate for a second, I can understand the strategy, because if you know, no matter how many friends, allies he has, he's going to have a limited number of resources to put 10 people, 20 people, 50 people looking through that massive dump. And if they find points A, B, and C as the hot story, he's going to be condemned because he didn't find G, K, and L, which are, in somebody else's opinion, hard, you know? And the other thing, and this is a philosophy of mine, and I know I'm horribly out of step with it, but I just assume that people are going to be people, that the number of saints among us is pretty damn slim. So I tend to expect my advocate friends, my progressive friends, to have, you know, feet made of flesh and toenails that scratch.
What is it, a saint has a past and a sinner has a future?
I understand there's actually people that Mother Teresa pissed off, you know?
Oh, she was a piece of work.
But listen, thank you so much. I appreciate your time, and I do hope to hear from you again soon.
Well, you know where to find me.
Okay, Dennis.
All the best, Rick. Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.